I didn't cover Spinoza a lot in the State of Sovereignty book that just came out, but what I've been interested in is two different lines of thought recently in continental philosophy, namely the vitalisms that one finds through Spinoza to Bergson to Deleuze, right, and the neo-Deleuzians, that Deleuzian stuff that you find in, say, figures like Liz Gross, but even Jane Bennett. And on the other hand, the critiques of vitalism that one finds in Agamben, Foucault, Canguilhem, and other figures, right? So we have this seem to have these two things going on. So I took the opportunity, I'm trying to think through this paper, how Spinoza sort of fits into the mix in terms of this form of immanentism. And what I have in mind, I didn't put it in the paper, so I'll just read it. This is from Deleuze's eminently readable Pure Immanence, Essays on a Life. This is the first part. This is actually the last thing he wrote before he died. And he asks, and I'll just read this because this will come up later. What is immanence a life? No one has described what a life is better than Charles Dickens, if we take the indefinite article as an index of the transcendental. A disreputable man, a rogue, held in contempt by everyone, is found as he lies dying. Suddenly those taking care of him manifest an eagerness, respect, even love for his slightest sign of life. Everybody bustles about to save him, to the point where, in his deepest coma, this wicked man himself senses something soft and sweet penetrating him. But to the degree that he comes back to life, his saviors turn colder, and he becomes once again mean and crude. Between his life and his death, there is a moment that is only that of a life playing with death. The life of the individual gives way to an impersonal and yet singular life that releases a pure event freed from the accidents of internal and external life, that is, from the subjectivity and objectivity of what happens. And so what I'm interested in is this notion of sort of like a pure life or pureness to it, and a certain notion of bliss that's coming out in Deleuze's last work that gets picked up by Agamben and others. So let me begin with another epigram from Deleuze concerning Spinoza. He writes in Spinoza, Practical Philosophy, "This frugal, propertyless life, undermined by illness," by the way, just like Deleuze, "this frail, thin body, how does one explain the impression they give of being suffused with life itself, of having a power identical to life? There," he says, "lies the glory and innocence of Spinoza, his own discovery. In a world consumed by the negative, he has enough confidence in life, in the power of life, to challenge death, the murderous appetite of men, the rules of good and evil, and the just and the unjust. Enough confidence in life to denounce all the phantoms of the negative." So for many of you, as you know, he takes on, Deleuze is sort of the anti-Hegelian who takes on the negativity one finds in Hegel in the name of the affirmation that he finds in Spinoza. So Spinoza writes succinctly at the end of the introduction of his political treatise, "The virtue of a state is its security." Let me cite this as the unalloyed core of modern politics, despite its denigration under the mottos of equality and liberty, and thus we are indeed the heirs of Spinoza. What he marks while playing the political realist, who refuses not to conceive men as he would like them to be, but merely as they are, is the movement of life itself to the center of our political mores. For millennia, Foucault famously noted in the first volume of The History of Sexuality, man remained what he was for Aristotle, a living being with the additional capacity for political existence. Modern man is an animal whose politics places his existence as a living being in question. This claim is made in a chapter entitled The Right of Death and Power Over Life, and mirrors much of what we also find in Hannah Arendt's depiction of the rise of the nation-state and the origins of totalitarianism. The study of this biopolitics and the security apparatuses meant to immunize the body politic has been nothing if not lively in recent years. Many of these studies track certain forms of sovereignty through Carl Schmitt's political theology, which depicts the sovereign as that being exceptional to the laws who decides over matters of life and death, friend and enemy. This transcendent form of politics, the sovereign is symmetrical for Schmitt to the theological role of God over nature, is avowedly Hobbesian. But my claim would be that one should pay attention to the rise of national sovereignty in modernity, a point so obvious and apparent that one is perhaps thought to be naive not to see the sovereign exceptionalism hovering over its surface. To the contrary, the works of Arendt and Foucault, albeit in different ways, trace these now racialized discourses in terms of immanentist forms of sovereignty that have been far from benign in carrying forth the dictates of safety and security. Another way to put this is in perhaps a polemical way, that there is an under-discussed biopolitics in Spinoza, who found it scandalous that men of reason could offer views of a monarchical god ruling over the cosmos from above. Rather, God is nature, the ultimate power and immanent cause, and just as Spinoza thought it best not to export our political visions onto the cosmos, so too he would use his own metaphysics to think an immanent politics grounded in the productive forms of power that operate more than by deduction of previous forms of sovereignty. For these and other reasons I'll discuss, it would be better to begin with Spinoza's political theology than that of Schmitt if we were studying the political shift we call modernism. While translating Hobbes' premises about the nature of man into his own ontology, Spinoza, just as he had done with the sovereign God with regard to nature, depicts sovereignty or imperium as immanent to the body politic. This, of course, will become a national sovereignty later on. In recent years, this has inspired politics in the form of Deleuzean assemblages and Hart and Agree's considerations of the common of the commonwealth. It will be this side of contemporary Spinozism that I will have in mind, though it's notable that Spinoza is also inspiring a renaturalization of ontology among neo-materialists, hoping to move beyond the philosophical linguistic turn and the last generation's supposed social constructivism. There is, then, a philosophy of life in Spinoza, Deleuze writes, but a provocative incantation for this lecture would be this: Spinozist vitalism is not extrinsic to the era of the biopolitical, and we should think seriously about whether we wish it to live on. Writing about another set of thinkers some 30 years ago, Jean-Luc Nancy writes, "Political or collective enterprises dominated by will to absolute immanence have as their truth the truth of death. That is, immanence, if it were to come about, would instantly suppress community, understood as plurality requiring communication and community in the first place, as such." I think this goes for all immanentist ontologies, but today my focus will be on Spinoza's biopolitics. That's actually a thesis I'll be testing out, whether it's the case for all immanentists, but let's see. At least since Foucault, what has been dubbed the study of biopolitics has argued that life as such is itself a political definition, that there is no life as such in all its innocence, not least because the category of the innocent life is our most politicized category, if one can speak this way. In other words, the question of life is one that is neither benign nor normatively neutral, but engages in a biologism that has centered our politics for a number of centuries. And in parentheses, and a side note, it's interesting that what Deleuze often affirms, despite his affinities with Foucault and Foucault's obvious admiration for him, Foucault then will cite just a year or two later as absolutely pernicious. The thinking of a pure life is biopower, horizontal assemblages become disciplinary power in Foucault, and so on. But then, so that's just a side note. Often people talk about Foucault and Deleuze as if they're interchangeable, but it's interesting that Deleuze will publish something on horizontal formations of power and rhizomatics, and then Foucault comes out with a book and says, oh, disciplinary power, good, and that sort of thing. But when did this politics of life begin? It is certainly productive of all our norms and political imaginaries. Who but a nihilist would wish to deliver us from a politics of life? What could be more natural than a politics of life, a politics that would defend life as such? Do we not begin to open ourselves to the possibility of the worst if we reveal or critique this kernel at the heart of the political? Can the questioning of the value of life as such even be done without risking a politics of death? Is this not the moral blackmail that biopolitics has always offered to thought? Who cannot, following Spinoza, affirm life as such? Who cannot, to use the American parlance, and I'm sorry for using the Americanism, be pro-life? It is also true that to attack Spinozism is considered on par with wanting to kill innocent life itself, as Deleuze suggests. This poor wastrel of a man, this innocent life, as Deleuze puts it. We philosophers and theorists admire those who have been threatened and excommunicated, as Spinoza was, those who have done their philosophy under the most arduous and dangerous conditions. But by this move, we flatter ourselves to think that we too brave the worst in merely being philosophers and theorists. It seems rude to our self-understanding to attack a Socrates or a Spinoza as if they didn't face enough in their own life, and especially if that means siding with those reactionary dogmatists who excoriated Spinozism for centuries after Spinoza died, having left unfinished his chapter on democracy in the political treatise. And now, centuries later, he's tellingly judged to be an innocent life, as if life itself were a matter of guilt or innocence, or a matter of those, quote, suffused with life itself, and those who are not, as if one can make any such juridical distinctions independent of a fully biopolitical logic. This, I think, by the way, is where I would take my distance from Deleuze's thinking of a life, which is notably found for him in a Dickens story where a rogue dies and is no longer a life when he's alive and well. Living, it seems, is for the bastards. But again, who but the most flagrant anti-realist would argue that our notions of life are politicized through and through? Isn't the naturalism of Spinoza an antidote to just this sort of post-Foucauldian thinking? This would be a mistake for two reasons. One, Spinoza's work evinces no distinction between the political and the natural. As he puts it in the Political Treatise, to think the political aside from natural categories would be to think an imperium within an imperium, which also has the upshot of being premised on the fact that sovereignty or imperium can never be shared, and thus any commonwealth must speak, as Spinoza argues again and again, with one voice and think with one mind, as he puts it, as if such a thing were possible or desirable. My concern deepens when one considers that for Spinoza, this thinking with one voice, this speaking with one voice, is not a telos or regulative ideal, since his metaphysics refutes such notions. This single voice must follow from the work of nature itself imminently unfolding. Two, Spinoza himself argues that the power of the state is productive of the forces of life itself. That is, the very kinetos, that is the essence of the living being in his ethics, while pronouncing what his liberal leaders wrongly take his unconditional affirmation of freedom of thought. Spinoza's ontology of powers, one exists in so much as one can act on others, leaves no room for transcendental appeals to rights, ethical principles, etc. And he equates right and power, that is, as the Straussians would preach to us, might is right. There are fair readings of Spinoza there, but I just want to point out that for him, there are productive, that the state itself works to produce and reinforce the living as such. This comes up numerous times in the Political Treatise. They're always on the watch out for life. I'll bring up a very pertinent example as we get to the end here. Let's zero in further. Spinoza's political claims derive from the ethics, where he argues that there is no other world, no other plane of existence than nature itself. That is, Spinoza's philosophy is engaged in thinking a pure immanence, as Deleuze rightly describes. Being is univocal. There is no Neoplatonic good beyond being, which in a sense also means that for Spinoza, there is no good, neither as telos nor as transcendent, let alone transcendental value, beyond the given concretion of acquired powers. In other words, he was Nietzschean before Nietzsche. On the other hand, there is no ontological difference in Spinoza, since there is only being, and all other entities are but manifestations of the immanent ground through the various modes and attributes. This would be substance as natura naturans, naturing nature, which can only be thought as the power productive of any given entity, whether in the mode of thought or in the mode of extended things. This is what is available to philosophical wisdom, reflecting on the laws of nature for him. On the other hand, there is substance as natura naturata, nature natured, that is, the flow of becoming, that is the manifestation of this all-powerful natura naturans. Thus one can study nature understood in its widest sense, either in terms of its unity, which requires philosophical wisdom, or in terms of its many multifarious effects, that is, power as it has instantiated itself, which, for example, is what politicians are particularly good at doing, as Spinoza argues at the beginning of the Political Treatise. For Deleuze, Spinoza evinces a trinitary structure, the substance that expresses itself, that particular attribute which expresses, and that mode which is expressed. This is also the place to mention what I take to be the crucial difference between Deleuze and his former student, Negri, where Negri emphasizes Spinoza as a thinker of being, as a thinker of ultimate homogeneity and unity. Deleuze thinks Spinoza goes too far in this direction, since his thinking privileges the substance behind its manifestations, thus betraying what Deleuze takes to be the principle of his immanentism, namely that being is equally present in all beings. That's a quote. That is, quote, Spinoza's substance appears independent of the modes, while the modes are dependent on substance, as though on something other than themselves. In simpler terms, this is why Deleuze is a thinker of becoming. That's why Negri is perhaps not. That's just throwing that out there. I haven't tested that out yet. Politically speaking, for Spinoza, his metaphysics means we must deal with the world not as it is, world as it is, not as we wish it would be. There is no other plane of possible existence to which we would compare our contemporary situation. Spinoza turns Platonism on its head, but in more than just a sense usually understood in terms of his thoroughgoing monism. While one could certainly point out how Plato's Republic, statesmen, and the laws minutely regulate the living and dying of its citizenry, the telos of this polis was for the sake of living well, not merely existing as such. The philosopher king required bravery in order to enter the affairs of the state, where it was understood that other principles prevailed. But for Spinoza, living itself is its own end. At this point, it's worth recalling his view of life as such. By life, he writes in his early work on Descartes, we, for our part, understand the force through which things persevere in their own being. End quote. In fact, the negation of death, as Hegel argues in the logic, is displaced from Spinoza's system. Since, as Spinoza puts it, quote, the free man thinks of death least of all things, and his wisdom is a meditation of life, not of death, unquote. The primary virtue in all senses, since he notes that no other is prior to this one, is, quote, for the canatus to preserve itself, since, quote, no one can desire to be happy, to do well, and to live well, without at the same time desiring to be, to do, and to live, that is, to barely exist, end quote. Where Aristotle left the necessities of the body to the oikos, which is the realm not just of necessity, but of sovereign mastery, yes, over women and children, Spinoza posits that politics comes about precisely as a necessary supplement to the needs of the conatus and its auto-effective desire for its own existence. Where Aristotle gives us a politics of freedom and equality, yes, for the few, in the political space, for Spinoza this freedom must be completely privatized. And the best that one could say is that his power politics provides for freedom of thought, but not action, and thus would be an indirect critique of all liberalism to follow. In the political treatise and the theological political treatise, this is known as the liberal Spinoza, that he gives us freedom of thought. But he again and again reminds us that it can never be freedom of action. And if you recall Arendt's dictum, that freedom of thought, she finds this in Sartre. Sartre says that you can be free in a prison. She finds this particularly galling. And she's attacking a line of Spinoza's views of power. So this could be thought of as a critique of all liberalism to follow. Provisions by the state for the chattering masses that itself would have no effect on the functioning of that state. Where for Aristotle, complete virtue was for the sake not just of living, but of living well, totally sane. Spinoza finds, quote, to act in absolute conformity with virtue is nothing else in us but to act, to live, to preserve one's own being. These three mean the same thing, end quote. What Aristotle calls praxis, Spinoza definitionally reduces to simply continuing one's existence. Living cannot be for the sake of anything else. Quote, nobody endeavors to preserve his being for the sake of some other thing, end quote. Thus, his politics will be about the protection of innocent life, that is, life unconditioned by want of anything more, a life, as Deleuze puts it, and thus we have the modern claim that, quote, innocent life is to be cherished, but the guilty laws of others are condemned by the same sovereignty that was to protect nothing other than this bare life. Even those who are often deemed post-metaphysical carry this vitalism forward. What else are we to make of Deleuze's conception of the indefinite life, that is, quote, a purely immanent life, the primary examples of which, as always, isn't it, are, quote, and this is Deleuze, small children infused with an immanent life that is pure power and even bliss, end quote. Another side note, how many theories of life demand this theoretical labor of children? One can never grow up too late, since childhood is, quote, complete power, complete bliss. But pure immanence, if there is such a thing, is nothing but death, not life, since it would be a black hole from which nothing returns. A life, to use Deleuze's phrase, as pure power, would be nothing of the kind, and any politics based on such a dream risks being childish, if no less deadly for all that. I'm being very polemical there. Otherwise put, life itself is, for Spinoza, the hidden natura naturans, the mystical power that our political modes merely manifest as this or that mode of politics, aristocracy, democracy, or monarchy. Readers such as Negri valorize this aspect of Spinoza, since it means that there is an always prior, quote, natural civitas, or commonwealth, that can enact different political modes to which it is irreducible. That is, there's always the power of revolt. But Spinoza's early readers didn't miss the import of this thinking of the common ground of the civitas for the incipient nationalisms of Europe, for which any given state is but a mode through which an original nation enacts itself. Spinoza's civitas has long been translated in French as nation, and his first translator was none other than the Comte Henri de Blondier, a Spinozist who, as both Foucault and Arendt point out at length, in the early 18th century, played a crucial role in the theoretical development of nationalism and the historical search for origins. Blondier is a sort of weird early 18th century character that comes up in society at a crucial place in society that must be defended, and also in Arendt's Origin of Totalitarianism. Spinoza's thinking requires, then, that the state be nothing other than the protector of the body politic. It is well known that in Hobbes, fear is the political passion par excellence, and that the task of the social contract is to move the individual from a state of generalized fear to the singular fear of the sovereign, who has a monopoly of producing awe in his subjects. As Spinoza himself puts it, quote, the main difference between the state of nature and civil society is this, that in civil order, all men fear the same things, and all have the same ground of security, the same way of life, end quote. But this fear is the flip side of a politics of security, since the contract is, quote, for the perpetual and not temporary security, as he puts it. Quote, the motive and end of the social contract is nothing else but the security of a man's person in his life and in the means of so preserving life as not to be weary of it, end quote. For these reasons, one finds in Spinoza's text multiple references to the state's right, that is, power mitigated by no other authority than carrying out the dictates of this inner principle of the whole, to, quote, compel enemies by, quote, whatever means, which, as he puts it, is arduous work. Here's a long quote from Spinoza. Anyone with any experience of the capricious mind of the multitude almost despairs of it, as it is governed not by reason but by passion alone. It is precipitate in everything. Everyone knows what wrongdoing people are often moved to commit because they cannot stand their present situation and desire a major upheaval. Here's the not-quite-revolutionary side of Spinozism. How blind anger and resentment of their poverty prompt men to act, and how much these things occupy and agitate their minds. To anticipate all this and construct a state that affords no opportunity for troublemaking, to organize everything in such a way that each person, of whatever character, prefers public right to private advantage, this is the real task, this is the arduous work. The necessity for this has compelled people to seek many stratagems, but they have never succeeded in devising a form of government that was not in greater danger from its own citizens than from foreign foes, which was not more fearful of the former than the latter. In other words, you fear your citizenry more than your foes. That is in some sense an opposition to Schmittianism, but I think it also explains a lot of the biopolitical logic we've seen in modernity, right? So friend-enemy distinction in Schmitt. Spinoza, I didn't notice until I just read this, but Spinoza flips it on his head and he says, no, you fear your friends more than your enemies, is another way to put it. Or, as he puts it more strongly in the political treatise, quote, it is also beyond doubt that a commonwealth is always in greater danger from its citizens than its enemies. And we will come back to this, what everyone knows, quote, this shared view of what is shared by every commonwealth, even if it can't be shared, precisely since this book is beyond doubt and one never has to discuss it. The biopolitical paradoxically presupposes both a literally innate living origin, quote, the same ground of security, that the state is to protect in terms of enforcing, quote, the same way of life, and that the threat itself comes from within the nation. It is as if the naturans, naturing nature, is always turning against its naturans. Nature is always turning against its naturans. And the sovereign exception is a supplemental force meant to protect the state, to immunize the body politic that threatens it from within. Thus, nationalist conceptions of homogeneity produce never-ending prostheses of police apparatuses for the safety and security of the multitude that never adheres enough to its living principle. As we will come to it, this is the reason why immanent sovereignism, Spinoza, and transcendental sovereignism, Hobbes, are the biopolitical doubles of one another, each supplementing the other in a deadly interplay meant to protect nothing but the life of the body politic, since life itself produces its supplemental prostheses that is never done, immunizing the common, since, of course, naturata is caught up in a perpetual motion, the perpetual security of which Spinoza speaks, that can't reach and secure the inner principle of the political's naturans. In other words, you're never pure enough. But otherwise, politics for Spinoza is always already fallen from its original substance, and despite its stated respect for those politicians who enact the principle, it is philosophy's wisdom to reflect wholly on the original substance and the origin of the political that is always then betrayed by its material conditions. Now, since what everyone knows is always already presumed, always already known, we're beginning to see a step away from Hobbes. The basis for later liberalism is Hobbes' discussion of the authorization by which we always already accede to the whim of the sovereign, since we would never decide to return to the state of nature. And it's also the case that he opens a space for market liberalism. The passions, he writes, that incline men to peace are fear of death, desire for such things as are necessary to commodious living, and a hope by their industry to obtain them, end quote. At this point, it will be useful to point out that the secondary literature does not take for granted that the political treatise and the theological political treatise by Spinoza offer visions of the same underlying political theory, with the latter, that is, the political treatise, leaving out, at least explicitly, a discussion of the Hobbesian-type contract. This, at least, is the claim of Negri, who champions reading the latter text in terms of the writing of Spinoza's predecessors. For Negri, this is important since it doesn't evince, quote, the negative and dialectical essence of contractarianism, which is also the terms he uses when critiquing a tradition that runs through Hegel and Heidegger. Spinoza doesn't have a being towards death. What is missing in Negri is that if Spinoza is, quote, rejecting the contractarian thematic, it is always in the name, is already in the name of an already constituted, and thus never constituted as such, body politic whose sovereign power and vitality is imminent to it. As Negri puts it, himself puts it, quote, the absolute imperium, which will become a term that, in signifying the unity of power, will have to assume it as a projection of the potential of subjects and define its totality as life, as the always open internal dynamic articulation of an organic whole. The gain found by Negri is that, unlike other forms of government, the democratic unity is taken by Spinoza as a given, natural fact, that is, quote, an autonomous productive force, wherein the power of being thus manifests itself in all its unifying force, end quote. This is precisely what one finds in all thinkers of nationalism, from Boulanger and Sieyès onwards. The crucial distinction between Hobbes and Spinoza, then, is to be found elsewhere. Hobbes' account centered on a multitude in the classical sense, when he discusses the solus populi, the safety of the people. Let's see if we can spot the difference. First, let's take a canonical moment from the Leviathan. A multitude of men are made one person, Hobbes' emphasis, when they are by one man and one person represented so that it be done with the consent of every one of that multitude in particular. For it is the unity of the representer, that is the monarch or whoever is the head of government, not the unity of the represented, that maketh the person one. And is the representer that beareth the person and but one person, and unity cannot otherwise be understood in multitude. And because the multitude naturally is not one, but many, they cannot be understood for one, but many authors of everything the representative saith or doth in their name. I like to use the word saith or doth. I'm going to drop that in sentences later today. Now, so notice that Hobbes is actually using a rather medieval, he's picked this up from Dante, De Monarchia and elsewhere, this idea that the people are the many, and the only unity to be found is through the power of the state, right? But there's no inherent unity to that multitude. Now, let's pull together several important moments in Spinoza. Human society, he writes, and this is a long quote, can thus be formed without any alienation of natural power, and the contract can be preserved in its entirety with complete fidelity only if every person transfers all the power they possess to society, that is, supreme power, which all must obey, either of their own free will or through fear of the ultimate punishment. The right of such a society is called democracy. Democracy is therefore properly defined as a united gathering of people which collectively has the sovereign power to do all that it has the right to do. It follows that the sovereign power is bound by no law, and everyone is obliged to obey it in all things. Here we seem to find an advance politically over Hobbes, and Spinoza is perhaps the first philosopher of modernity to argue for democracy, which for him is, quote, a state and government where the safety of the whole people, not that of the ruler, is the supreme law, end quote. Spinoza moves a step further. Let's recall, we've already seen that all citizens must live in the same manner, arguing that the commonwealth must be thought to be an immanent whole. He writes, we see then that the individual is not in control of his own power, but is a subject to the power of the commonwealth, whose every command he is bound to carry out. And he does not have any power to decide what is fair or unfair, what is righteous or unrighteous. On the contrary, since the body of the state, imperium is the word he uses here, which is also the word used by Hobbes, must be guided as if by a single mind, and consequently the will of the commonwealth must be regarded as the will of all. What the commonwealth decides to be just and good must be held to be so, decided by every citizen. Spinoza repeats this formulation, as if by one mind, or as it were by one mind, una voluti mente, throughout the political treatise and his discussion of the Braic state in the theological political treatise. At one point, he inserts this as if, tonquam, in a quotation from Tacitus about the one mind of the body politic. In other words, he takes a quote from Tacitus and inserts the as if into it. Thus, it was clearly considered phrasing in his text. This hesitation of the as it were, or as if, before proclaiming that one mind is necessary for the body politic, which, quote, has but one purpose, which is nothing other than the peace and security of life, may be read as a decisive pulling back from thinking the common as always already constituted, as truly acting by one mind, and thus for Spinoza, one body. But to read it this way would be to misunderstand Spinoza's metaphysical politics. Since the body or mind are but attributes of an underlying substance, hence it would be a category mistake to think the civitas as being united in mind, since the mind is the effect of the underlying power, not the power itself. Thus, the as it were one mind is the expression of the substance's move from potential to act. The mind is the intermediary between the substance and its particular instantiation in this or that mode, this or that state apparatus. Quote, the right of the state or of the sovereign, Spinoza writes, is nothing more than the right of nature itself, and is determined by the power not of each individual, but of a people, which is guided as if by one mind. And accordingly, the task is, quote, to bring everyone's resources, if we can call it that, into one body, the body of a society. Thus, for Alexandre Maturin, quote, political society, paraphrasing Spinoza here, political society is not created by a contract. It is engendered and re-engendered at each moment by a consensus that must be permanently renewed, end quote. But this bespeaks not a political pluralism, but the emptying out of the political as such, which must follow from the laws of necessity, that is, the imminent unfolding of the national substance, wherein, quote, all must emerge from properties that the multitude has in common. Spinoza writes, either there is no sovereignty nor any right over subjects, or else sovereignty must necessarily extend to everything that might be effective in inducing men to submit to it. Thus, whatever a subject does that complies with the sovereign commands, whether elicited by love or forced by fear, he still does by right of the sovereign, not his own. And while it is impossible, of course, to control people's mind to the same extent as their tongues, still minds, too, are to some degree subject to the sovereign power, which has various ways to ensure that a very large part of the people believes, loves, hates, etc., what the sovereign wants them to. Our conclusion is that, without logical contradiction, we can conceive of men who believe, love, hate, despise, or exhibit any passion whatsoever owing to the power of the state alone. I would note that in the Ethics, when he talks about the Conatus and what it can do, that is life for him. These loving, hating, despising, and those other passions. Needless to say, this passion is what, in Spinoza, is central to life itself, its essence. And we will see how this will drive his biopatriarchal politics. Here we see the circularity of Spinoza's biopolitics. The state is the effect of the common substance, yet it must constantly and ceaselessly work to produce the essence of the effects whose effect it was supposed to be. For Negri, the democratic substance, i.e. the common, as prior to any state, means that, quote, democracy is the highest form in which society is expressed. Though one wonders how this or that form can make sense as higher or lower in a spinozistic conception, because it falls from any particular state would follow from the laws of cause and effect. In any event, it is the highest form in which society is expressed because it is the most expansive form which natural society is expressed as political society. It is, in positive terms, the liberation of all social energies in a general conatus of the organization of the freedom of all, continual and permanent, end quote. And this political society, as in a state of emergency, may require dictatorship, Negri writes, which, quote, may tend towards absolutism and a state of war, which, in this case, can transform the possible state of war into an organic movement of refoundation and thereby restore the vigor to the state, end quote. You can see the organic metaphors and the vitalism there, Negri. Despite himself, Negri pronounces the transcendental immanentist logic of the biopolitical. That process of the incessant need of the living being to preserve itself, to renew its vitality and vigor, to conquer those threats internal and external. There is thus never a pure immanence, never a pure life, since it always requires the prosthesis of the state that will police the health and safety of the body politic, all while producing the very conatus that was to be its driving force. Alas, the dead bastards that we would ostracize from our communities, as in Deleuze's story taken from Dickens to represent pure life, have a way of coming back to life, to communities that would wish something other than the differentiation and difference. Right? This is the underlying politics of that story in Dickens. This brings us to the most perplexing reason to see such a political immanentism heralded by post-Althusserian Marxists such as Etienne Balibar and Antonio Negri. To the revolutionary dictum that, quote, another world is possible, Spinoza's reply is that this is the only world there is, that it necessarily flows from an all-powerful immanent cause, and that the only wisdom one can have is to reflect on God, that is nature, in terms of its all-encompassing causality. This neo-Stoicism, then, will herald a completely privatized freedom of thought, while all action is to flow from the necessity of the power of the state and its tending to the safety and protection of life. One could see in Spinoza, then, a wonderful passkey to the liberalism that was to follow. The apparatus of the state with regard to its legitimacy in matters of life and death is to remain unquestioned. All a speech is to be freed in matters of private reason. Quote, freedom of spirit or strength of mind is the virtue of a private citizen. In sum, we have the charade that centuries later, Arendt would find in Sartre's depiction of one being free and in a prison, an absurdity to those who think freedom is something other than that which occurs in the privacy of one's body or mind, unrelated to a web of relations with others for her. It is no wonder that the best Negri can offer, for example, is that his Spinoza system is, quote, based on trying to understand how the concept of democracy could have been expressed in the theological political treatise. In other words, Spinoza dies before it's finished. And so Negri says, well, we'll just see how it would have turned out, which is a nice way to finish novels as well, to stop before it ends. And it also happens that Spinoza ends, as I'll talk about, with the most biopolitical logic in relation to women. But we do not have to travel into the biopolitical future after Spinoza, or looking at what he might have read, to see the status of his biopolitics. As always, the biopolitical never neglects the role of women and reproduction. Even if it's notable that in the work of Foucault, Esposito, Agamben, and Negri, the biopolitics of women is simply ignored or denigrated. And we don't need to engage in the necrophilia of fantasies about what Spinoza would have written if only he hadn't died. Here we see how the biopolitics founds all political naturalisms, which, as in Spinoza, forms a determined causal relation between nature and the political, between natura, naturans, and natura, naturata. This is the longest quote, but it's an important one. These are his last words, so I've read from Deleuze's last words, and now Spinoza's. But perhaps someone will ask whether women are under men's... You do not want these to be your last words, by the way. Maybe Spinoza did. But perhaps someone will ask whether women are under men's authority by nature or institution. For if it has been by mere institution, then we had no reason compelling us to exclude women from government. But if we consult experience itself, we shall find that the origin of it is in their weakness. And for there has never been a case of men and women reigning together. But wherever on the earth men are found, there we see that men rule, and women are ruled, and that on this plan, both sexes live in harmony. But if by nature women were equal to men, and were equally distinguished by force of character and ability, in which human power and therefore human right chiefly consist, surely among nations so many and different, some would be found, where both sexes rule alike, and others where men are ruled by women, and so brought up, and that they make less use of their abilities. And since this is nowhere the case, one may assert with perfect propriety that women have not by nature equal right with men, but that they necessarily give way to men, and that that thus it cannot happen that both sexes should rule alike, much less that men should be ruled by women. But if we further reflect upon human passions, how men, in fact, generally love women merely from the passion of lust, let that linger for a bit, and esteem their very interesting life. Love women merely from the passion of lust and esteem their cleverness and wisdom in proportion to the excellence of their beauty, and also how very ill-disposed men are to suffer the women they love to show any sort of favor to others, and other facts of this kind, we shall easily see that men and women cannot rule alike without great hurt to peace. But of this, I've said enough. As Anna Sharp rightly asks, if Spinoza's concern throughout his political treatise is to institute the most robust and harmonious form of sovereignty, in which the commonwealth is guided as much as possible by one mind, why exclude a vast majority of the population from the business of running the state and determining its representatives? Sharp notes a whole literature in recent years that finds Spinoza's views on women surprising. My take, however, is that one cannot excise the blank page, that is the name given to his last words, as a contingent feature of Spinoza's system, not least because of the irony that Spinoza's system evinces no concept of the surprise, or indeed contingency itself. Everything is determined in cause and effect relations. This is the first thing you learn about Spinoza. And on each point, one could find an isonomous description between the depiction of women and the multitude itself, which is weak and misdirected in its passions. Hence, quote, we despair, he says, over the capricious mind of the multitude. Politics here follows by right of nature, and where there is the imminentist of a naturalized biological society, it is unreasonable women who threaten the fraternity of men and their politics of friendship. One cannot even argue that this is simply how right has formed in particular societies, since for Spinoza, this would be the unfolding of an immanent substance, the civitas, by force of nature. Thus women, by nature, Spinoza consistently argues, must be weaker, even if this must be, this necessity is born of a logic that itself can admit no empirical counterpoint. Hence the dubious claim that never have women and men ruled together. To bring what should be a longer discussion to a conclusion, Spinoza's system requires bringing the reproduction of life under the aegis of the political, since this imperium, first and foremost, is the power or right over life and death. Women, as producers of life, must be regulated in the male domination of reason, which in Spinoza is simply the wisdom of reflecting upon the necessity of what is. That is, the body of women are passive entities that receive but do not produce the conatus of men. They do not have the full life of men. They are never innocent. They never have an active conatus, and they are always ready guilty of being the object of the conatus of men, whose passions are so apparent in the multitude. A couple months ago in Republican circles, Rick Santorum completed the Spinozist circle by saying women should never serve in combat because the moment they are there, it's not about protecting the women. It's what would the men do? If they see the women, this is exactly Spinoza's logic. So always in the history of patriarchy, the women are literally excluded from the conversation. It's not that they're setting out to oppress women. It's actually that they're excluded and said, no, they're a threat to men, right? In any case, that's well known. Where did I leave off? Rick Santorum, suddenly I'm... that receive. Spinoza hence likens, they literally embody, the feminine then is the enemy, is the name for the enemy within the state. They literally embody what will weaken men in the life of the body politic. Spinoza hence likens, and these are his quotes, consorting with harlots and also ravishing maidens by those in power as akin to a state of war. Thus, the state will keep women from rule as a kind of political Viagra for men to regain their vitality, all in the name of keeping life safe. The biopolitical, as we know in the United States and North America more generally, always regulates women in particular in the name of being pro-life. This patriarchal logic can evince no principles of difference, and life must be produced out of one mind, out of the auto-affection or masturbatory logic that sees the other as a dangerous temptation for the work of this one body. But such an immanentism would mean political death. States do need to produce the very citizens it is to secure, after all. So it will be up to the state to watch over the reproduction between men and women, since, alas, we will never again be small children infused with an imminent life that is pure power and even bliss. And this vigilance over reproduction and the worries over the weakness of men and their jealous desires is precisely the logic of patriarchal nationalism, even when written by a, quote, weak, sickly man forever fascinated by his potency. It is time to leave these forms of naturalisms behind, or at least to begin to see how such a life is produced in and through the political, which is always engaged in the arduous work of policing the security of life. For Spinoza, no other world is possible, and all that would be political has always already been put in line by nature itself. And politics is to be led, as he never tires of writing, by superstition and the sad passions of hope and fear, since the feminized masses, reduced to pure embodiment, cannot engage in the life of the mind. But beyond this Spinozism, life goes on, because finding a space for something other is the work of politics, unworking the imminent systems that have come down to us. All that is not for another day. However, beyond this politics of hope and fear comes the hope for living another tomorrow. Thank you.